Okay, so let us continue. And now we have come to the, we're coming to the conclusion of the Bhojangas, the factors of awakening. The first one is a little sutta that doesn't say so much about the Bhojangas, but it says some, still has a, some interesting content, and is kind of concerned with that in a slightly indirect way. And then the last sutta here is more like a bit of an overview and how the Bhojangas fit in on the path overall. So we're going to hopefully go through those two suttas now. That's the idea. So the first sutta is from the Bhojanga Samyutta. Again, the connected discourse is chapter 46, sutta number 16. And the sutta is called Sik. So let's see how it goes. This is how the sutta goes. At one time, the Buddha was staying near Rajagaha in the bamboo grove, the squirrel's feeding ground. Now, at that time, he was sick, suffering, and gravely ill. Then Venerable Mahachunda went up to the Buddha, bowed, and sat down to one side. And the Buddha said to him, "Chunda, express your understanding of the awakening factors." So, the Buddha has rightly explained these seven awakening factors. When developed and cultivated, they lead to direct knowledge, to awakening, and to extinguishment. What seven? The awakening factors of mindfulness, investigation of principles, the awakening factor of energy, the awakening factor of rapture, the awakening factor of tranquility, the awakening factor of immersion, and the awakening factor of equanimity. These are the seven awakening factors that the Buddha has rightly explained. When developed and cultivated, they lead to direct knowledge, to awakening, and to extinguishment. Indeed, Chunda, these are awakening factors. Indeed, Chunda, these are the awakening factors. This is what Chunda said, and the teacher approved. And that's how the Buddha recovered from that illness. So, it's just interesting because sometimes the suttas that are hard to understand are interesting because it's just hard to make sense of it, to know what's going on. And here we have the Buddha getting free, rid of an illness by having one of the monks recite the seven factors of awakening. It's kind of strange. You would have thought the Buddha might be able to kind of think of these seven factors himself. Why does he need someone from the outside to recite these seven factors of awakening? And wherever there is something interesting going on like this, there's also something to be understood. So it's often useful to contemplate these things a little bit. And this is why I kind of brought it out, because this is kind of a good opportunity to look at the sutta like that. It's hard to get opportunities to look at such suttas. You have to kind of find, you know, when it fits into the framework a little bit. And now it fits reasonably well. So I thought I might bring it up. What's the story here? So obviously the Buddha is really ill. Mahachunda, he's one of the very famous monks at the time. I think he was a younger brother of Venerable Sariputta, and he was supposed also have to be an arahant as well. So he was a very special monk, not just any old monk. The Buddha specifically asks him to recite these awakening factors. So the question is, a sutta like this, is it possible that it has been added later on? Because it seems so strange. Does the Buddha need someone to express these things to be able to rise out of that illness? To me, the answer is that quite likely it is original. It's an original sutta, because it is one of those things that anything which seems highly unlikely, it is very unnatural for someone to be able to put it in there, because everyone would say, "You can't put that in there. That is not like the Buddha we know." So things that seem unlikely, that kind of go against the stream of what you think the Buddha is, are actually often likely to be original, precisely because they are so unlikely to have been inserted by someone else. This is one of the principles of what they call text criticism. You may have heard about biblical scholars back in the 19th century, especially the Germans were very big on biblical scholarship, and they used certain principles to decide what was most likely to be the original teachings of the Bible, what had been added later on, and they deconstructed the Bible pretty much completely. One of the first kind of really secular undertaking to deconstruct the Bible. And they use certain principles to decide on matters, what was authentic, what was not, and all these kind of things. And one of the principles, one of these principles is, I can't remember now, but I think this is one of those principles that was used at that time, the idea that if something seems unlikely, it speaks against the normal attitude that the church has, then it is often authentic, precisely because the church wouldn't have invented this simply because it goes against the attitude of the church. And the same thing in Buddhism. What later Buddhists would have been unlikely to put in there very often is likely to be authentic for exactly the same reason. So I think this is authentic. And so how does it work then if it is authentic? And the answer is, I think, if you think back first of all, to what happened in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta. I talked about this briefly before. And the Buddha gets very sick during the rains retreat to the point where he almost dies. And then he says, I have to use my energy to check the illness so I can kind of say goodbye to the my Upatak, my attendant, and all the monks and everyone else. So he checks it using energy. So energy is one of these principles that kind of give rise or kind of you can get rid of illnesses with. So I think the answer to this one here is simply that Buddha had a physical body like everybody else. It shows us more of what we might call the humanity of the Buddha and not his supernormal qualities. And because he was severely ill, his energy had dropped down. He didn't have any energy anymore. And probably he needed someone from the outside to kind of remind him of these things and say them with a lot of faith and confidence so that he, when he hears it, the energy and the inspiration of hearing the teaching actually re-arises again in the Buddha, just as it would with anyone else. When you hear these teachings in a certain way, in an inspired way, it gives rise to much more confidence and positive feeling than if you hear it in a kind of a dull way with someone who doesn't really understand them or someone who is ill and hasn't got that energy there. I think that's all there's to it. And then when the Buddha hears about these beautiful factors of awakening and he hears these powerful, beautiful states of mind that lead eventually to the full awakening, actually even the Buddha gets the energy back and then he overcomes the illness in that way. So for me, this is just again a reminder of the humanity of the Buddha. He was human like the rest of us, and when he had illnesses, then he would have had similar problems to what we have when we are ill. So it's important again just to remember what makes the Buddha special, and those things that are special and those things that are more ordinary that actually make him human, just like everyone else. So that is that little tiny little sutta, and just kind of because it's interesting, I brought it in there. I hope you forgive me for bringing in these random suttas into the thing, but that's kind of one of the nice things about being the teacher. You can do whatever you want. So I'm being naughty, using my position of absolute power to really okay, anyway, so now let's move on to the next one. Next one is called the Kundalya Sutta. Kundalya Sutta is also from the Bodhanga Sanyutta. This is number 6 in the Bodhanga Sanyutta, and it goes as follows. At one time, the Buddha was staying near Saketa in the deer park at the Anjana Wood. Then the wanderer Kundalya went to the Buddha, exchanged greetings with him, and when the greetings and polite conversation were over, he sat down to one side and said to the Buddha, Master Gautama, I like to hang around the monasteries and visit the assemblies. When I finish breakfast, it's my habit to wander from monastery to monastery, from park to park. There I see some ascetics and Brahmins speaking for the sake of winning debates and finding fault. So here you have the Buddha staying. This is one of the places he stays quite rarely, Anjana Wood. Saketa is one of the great cities in ancient India, one of the 6 great cities as they are listed in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta just before the Buddha passes away. Venerable Ananda says to the Buddha, why are you going to die in this tiny little hamlet in the middle of the jungle, Kushinara, when there are these great cities? Ananda is not pleased with the Buddha for dying in the wrong place. And then and as if, you know, you necessarily not necessarily choose where you're going to die. But anyway, and then he lists these six great cities suggesting where the Buddha should die. And one of those six great cities happens to be Saketa. But it's not the place where the Buddha goes very often. It seems to have been in the Kosala kingdom, not too far, somewhere between Benares and Sarvati, something like that. Then they exchange greetings with each other. That is one of the things that is always nice to point out with the suttas, how the Buddha is always very polite and friendly. He is not a very forbidding person. I mentioned in the beginning, I talked about the Buddha being kind of, you know, his humanity and looking at the recollection of the Buddha. This is another thing I should have mentioned right away here. The Buddha often has a polite conversation with people initially. Not long, not really small talk. You wouldn't call it small talk. It's more like, how are you? I hope you're well, that kind of thing. A little bit small talkish, but not kind of talking about the weather and that kind of stuff. So not like, yeah, no. Anyway. So he does that, and this is in a friendly way, which this is important to remember as Buddhists, so that we don't become too kind of forbidding for other people to kind of meet with us. They're kind of not too scary. Then he sits down to one side, and he talks about kind of going around the monasteries and assemblies. This was, I think, quite a common thing in those days, because that was kind of, I suppose, a kind of entertainment even. It was a mixture of entertainment and spiritual uplift, or spiritual, gaining something spiritually. And so this is what they do. And a lot of these people, they would have been masters of debate. Yeah, debating was a big thing here. And they would kind of try to win the debate. And when you won the debate, that meant your doctrine was presumably better than the doctrine of others. But very often, the idea of winning debate is not really all that useful. If that is what you live for, it really obviously has to do with building up your ego and your sense of self. If you have a debate for the sake of discovering truth, it's okay. But most of the time, these debates, they just become endless kind of ego-boosting exercise. And in that sense, they are really, really kind of useless. Actually, they're not only useless, they are bad from a spiritual perspective, because they drag you down rather than lift you up. So these wanderers probably would have been a wide variety. Some of them may have been more serious about debating real things. Others would have been just about fault-finding, as it says here. So then Kundalya, he asked the Buddha, what benefit does the master Gotama live for him? And then the Buddha says, the benefit the realized one lives for, Kundalya, is the fruit and knowledge of freedom. So these two words again, these are the highest benefits you can have on the Buddhist path. And this is the benefit that the Buddha has lived for in the past. Now presumably he has realized it, he helps other beings get it, but he has it's already there. And knowledge here, of course, is the insight into reality, understanding things as they actually are. And that knowledge always brings with it liberation. These are two sides of the same coin. Because when you fully see reality, that means that you abandon those things that are contrary to that reality, and you get liberated as a consequence, because you're no longer mistaken. You know the path, you know what this is all about. So insight and understanding and liberation are always two sides of the same coin. Not being deluded means also, by definition, that you are free at the same time. Free from what? Free from suffering, free from defilements, free from all these negative things in the world. Vidya Vimutti often works as a compound in this way. And then we have this interesting conversation. We have seen a little bit of this before, but the conversation about how this comes about. And then Kundalya says, but what things must be developed and cultivated in order to fulfill knowledge, or if you like, insight and freedom? And he says the seven awakening factors. Yeah, and this is actually very useful to note this every time you see it, because the seven awakening factors are really about samadhi practice in the final analysis. That is where they lead to. They lead to the upeka and lead to the samadhi. That is kind of what they are all about. So once again, this shows you that insight is really about, comes from samadhi. Real insight comes from samadhi. And this is kind of a theme throughout the suttas. You see it again and again. Once you start to notice these things, you see how incredibly prevalent it is. So it's a very important point, because it means that you understand what it is you have to develop if you want to go all the way to the end of the path. Samadhi is a thing that makes final insight possible. But then, is the other side of the coin? When he asks, but what things must be developed and cultivated in order to fulfill the seven awakening factors? And the Buddha replies, the four kinds of mindfulness meditation, the four satipatthanas. And this is another one of those very important things that you see again and again in the suttas once you start reading them. And that is that mindfulness, the purpose of the satipatthanas is always to lead to samadhi. And then the samadhi takes you to awakening after that. And that sequence is so important. You can't really skip, you can't just kind of do satipatthana practice without the samadhi and expect awakening to arise. It doesn't work like that. You need that depth of meditation, takes you all the way to samadhi to enable you to reach awakening. In part, that is because, as I mentioned before, it is all based on what we saw before, nirodha, yeah, the cessation is based on viraga. In other words, you want things to fade away to the maximum before you can really understand properly what they are about. And then the insight comes from that. And that tells us a lot about this path and what these things are for. So satipatthana, the purpose of satipatthana is samadhi. So satipatthana is, you can say on one hand, it is a samatha practice, it is a practice to calm you down. It is not normally understood as that, but this is one of the very important functions of satipatthana, is samatha, calming down. Satipatthana is not just a vipassana practice, as it is sometimes taught. It is very much, has very much to do with samatha. Yeah, and this is what you see throughout the suttas again, if you look at it. But also, the fact that it leads to samadhi does not mean that it doesn't have a vipassana component, because vipassana too leads to samadhi if it is done in the right way. Because vipassana is just seeing things clearly, and when you see things clearly, it enables you to abandon those things that don't lead you to samadhi. So satipatthana practice is both samatha and vipassana, but it is a particular type of samatha vipassana. It is that type of samatha vipassana that leads to samadhi. And then once you have attained samadhi, then you take that even deeper, and then you eventually achieve the full awakening as a consequence. So often people ask, what about stream entry? Where does it happen in this? Does it happen before or after samadhi? Don't worry about that. It's irrelevant where it happens. It is most likely to happen after samadhi, but it's impossible from the suttas to say that it cannot happen at all before samadhi. Maybe it can, but it's irrelevant. All we have to do is practice the path in the right way, and then the results will come. Yeah, at some stage it will come. Whether it happened before or after samadhi is irrelevant. You just practice the path, which includes the samadhi, and see where it takes you. And then you are doing the right thing. It becomes, otherwise, if we start thinking too much about is one thing necessary or not, very often what that results in is that you decide that certain things are not required, and that is where you go wrong. It's much better just to practice things as they are and allow the results to happen in whatever order they will as you practice along here. So then he asks, what things must be developed and cultivated in order to fulfill the four kinds of mindfulness meditation, the three kinds of good conduct? Yeah, three kinds of good conduct, the tini sucharitani. Charita is conduct, su is good, good conduct. And very interesting, what is, again, this is something we have been talking about throughout, is the idea that it is sila that supports mindfulness meditation, and really all you require is really good sila. assuming that you have already established a certain amount of right view as the very foundation. Sila is the thing that makes mindfulness meditation possible. So again, it is, if your meditation has only goes so far, if it plateaus at a certain point, where do you need to look? You need to look at your sila. You need to look at your moral conduct. Can you improve a little bit? And this is really the holy grail of Satipatthana practice, and this is where this is kind of the thing that makes Satipatthana practice possible. Always come back to your sila. Always ask yourself whether you can purify it just a little bit more. And remember, it is a very profound thing to purify your sila, because it means all the good conduct, avoiding the bad. It means at the very level of the mind that we kind of think in the right way, we act in the right way mentally. It is very comprehensive, and it's a daunting task in some ways to purify our sila completely. But the ideal way of purifying the sila is from moment to moment to do the right thing. From moment to moment to have that yoniso manasikara that enables you to do the right thing consistently all the time. That is really what it is ideally about. So it's impossible to do that fully. Even the stream mentor kind of messes up sometimes. But it is possible to do a little bit better than what we're doing, and gradually moving in that direction. And as you do so, and you put more good motivation into your actions, one of the important things about sila is to make sure that your motivations are as positive as possible. So it is possible to do good in many ways. You can do good kind of more or less kind of a little bit carelessly perhaps, or you can put a lot of good motivation and intention into that act of goodness. So all of these things are part of that, imbuing all your actions with that kind of positive energy, and then it really becomes powerful. So this gives you kind of the key, the key to how to make Satipatthana meditation work. Tini Sucharitani, good conduct combined with the right view, the view that allows you to prioritize in the right way, so at all times you prioritize in the way that is leading forward on the path. A lot of what we are seeing here is the connection between the various Bodhipakya Dhammas that we have seen so far. So we have the four mindfulness meditations, which are the support for the seven factors of awakening. We have the three kinds of good conduct, which is very closely related to the four right efforts. So that is three of the sets. And part of this is also the Iddhipadas. So all of these sets, in a sense, come together when we in this kind of exposition that you have here, because it is really a complete exposition of the path. And then Kundalia asks, but what things must be developed and cultivated in order to fulfill the three kinds of good conduct? And the answer is sense restraint. It's kind of perhaps surprising that you should say that. It is perhaps not obvious why that should fulfill that. But the point, of course, is that sense restraint is the hardest part to fulfill of good conduct, because it has to do with the mind. So it is already assumed that your conduct by body and speech, they're already quite good, because that comes first. And to fulfill the three kinds of good conduct, you have to focus on the mind rather than on your speech and your body. So that is why sense restraint comes there as a factor that completes good conduct. So this is how that works, because that is where the mind concerns the mind. And Kundalia, the Buddha continues, how is sense restraint developed and cultivated so as to fulfill the three kinds of good conduct? And here is an alternative version to the sense restraint formula. You find different versions of it in the suttas, and just to give you slightly different angles from which to see and understand what is going on. A mendicant sees an agreeable sight with their eye. They don't desire it or enjoy it, and they don't give rise to greed. The mind and body are steady internally, well settled and well freed. But if they see a disagreeable sight, they are not dismayed. The mind isn't hardened, dejected, and full of ill will. The mind and body are steadied internally, well settled, well freed. So it's similar to the previous sense restraint, the idea that you don't give rise to In the other one, they have the words abhijja dormanasa, and this here kind of fleshes out a little bit the ideas of those two words. Abhijja, we translate it as desire, or are translated as desire, and here it is kind of fleshed out with desire, enjoying, and greed. Yeah, so it kind of makes it very clear what is meant by that. And Domanasa, which I translated as aversion, is here, according to Pantasudrata's translation, dismayed, hardened, dejected, and full of ill will. So again, a similar kind of thing. It gives us broadens out the idea of what is meant by these words. So you don't allow the mind to be caught up in these things. You have a steady mind that kind of flows through daily life. You allow mindfulness to be there at all times, and you flow through life as a kind of in a light way, without being oppressed by these kind of things. And it's interesting, it then says here that the mind is steady internally, yeah? It's steady, it doesn't waver because of all these objects, it doesn't fluctuate up and down, miserable one moment, elated the next moment, but you have a certain evenness of the mind, it's steady. And of course, with that steadiness comes the mindfulness. You have the ability to be mindful, because you're not drawn out by all of these objects of the world. Well settled, yeah? Similar thing to steady. Freed. It's really nice. You are actually free when you are able to restrain your mind in this way, using the wisdom power. This is what freedom is in Buddhism. It is almost the exact opposite of what people take to be freedom in the world. And this is why the Buddha says sometimes that what the noble ones take to be happiness, the ordinary people take to be suffering. What the ordinary people take to be happiness, the noble ones take to be suffering. Yeah, the opposite. Freedom is not in being able to choose and pursue the objects of the five senses. Freedom is being rid of that entire craving and the entire aversion to the objects of the five senses. That is the true freedom, because you feel in control of yourself. You feel that you can make real choices. You feel that you can see clearly what is going on instead of being biased by these kind of defilements. So that is the real freedom, and it also feels much better at the same time. So it's always fascinating to see how the Dhamma is different from the ordinary worldly way of living here. So that is the how then the sense restraint fulfills the three kinds of good conduct. And what is interesting is that this sutta here, there is another sutta which actually brings this whole sequence even further back, and then it asks what is the cause, what is the nutriment for sense restraint, and it brings it back and back and back. And I haven't included that sutta here because sometimes you don't know exactly what's going to happen on these retreats, what the sutta says, it says that the nutriment or the things that support sense restraint is sati sampajanya. In other words, mindfulness and full awareness. I mentioned sampajanya before. Sampajanya is this ability to understand the purpose and suitability of things. Yeah. So when you have clarity about the purpose of your life, you know where you are heading. You know what is important. You know you want to fulfill the spiritual aspects of your life. Then naturally sense restraint arises, because you know that you're only going to be able to fulfill these things if you have sense restraint. So the idea of being clear about what is important in life, how you're going to fulfill it, it underlies the ability to have sense restraint. And you have to have a degree of sati with that. You will have noticed what is quite interesting about this. Sati sampajanya is the cause for sense restraint. Sense restraint is the cause for fulfilling the three kinds of good conduct. The three kinds of good conduct is the cause for satipatthana, sati again. So the word sati, mindfulness, occurs in two different places in this set. And it makes you wonder, well, what is it? And of course, the point is that sati comes in a large variety of different strengths. But the initial sati, to be able to have sense restraint, you have to have a degree of sati to be able to be aware of what is going on, to remember the instructions, to have that memory of doing what is purposeful and suitable to develop the path. So sati comes in different areas. So this is the initial sati that allows you to be able to be aware of what is going on. The later sati is a sati of mindfulness and meditation, where you don't really think anymore, where the mind is clear and you have clarity about what is going on and what is happening here. So this is what you can often expect in the suttas. You have to be a little bit flexible with how these concepts are used, because they are used in different ways depending on where they're at. So you have that mindfulness, and the instruction is to move forward on the path, then sense restraint becomes possible. So what is the cause of sense sati sampajanya, of mindfulness and clear comprehension? The cause for that is yoniso manasikara. Yoniso manasikara is wise reflection. Manasikara means attention. Yoniso means something like wise or careful or something like that. And yoniso manasikara is the ability to reflect on the world so that the good qualities in you grow and the bad qualities decline. Every time you have wise reflection, a wise outlook, a wise attention to what is going on, your mind is moving towards increasing the good qualities in yourself and making the bad qualities go down. This is the definition of yoniso manasikara found in the Sabhasava Sutta, the second sutta of the Majjhima Nikaya. That's how you know you have yoniso manasikara. So every time you sit down, you become more peaceful in your meditation. That's yoniso manasikara, because you're moving away from the defilements and moving towards the positive states of mind instead. Every time you decide to do something good, every time you decide to restrain yourself from doing something bad, all of that is yoniso manasikara, because you're heading in the right direction. And this is one of those very important words in the Buddhist teachings, and it comes into effect from the very beginning. The moment you start to decide to practice these teachings, all the way to final awakening and everything in between that takes you in the right direction, all of that is yoniso manasikara, every time you move towards the goal. So it is a very broad term, and it is very useful to remember that, because of course if you have that, then all of these other factors will come as a consequence. So what is the cause of yoniso manasikara? What makes us have wise reflection? And the answer to that in that sutta is sadha, confidence or faith, in the Dhamma. And it may sound strange how wisdom can come from faith, but this is exactly what we would expect in the Buddha's teachings. As I mentioned before, wisdom and faith are so closely connected to each other. And initially, we don't really know where to look ourselves. We don't really know what is wholesome and is unwholesome. We don't have that outlook on the world that the Buddha has. So initially, it has to come from a degree of confidence in some teachings that we can relate to. So once you come across the word of the Buddha, you gain some confidence in these teachings. They become your guide. So those teachings actually tell you what is yoniso manasikara, what is wise reflection or wise attention. So you need a guide, and that is where the sadha comes in. And you can see the closeness again between sadha and wisdom, confidence and wisdom. When you have confidence in the right thing, you know where to place your confidence, then you also have a degree of wisdom. You draw the wisdom from those teachings, and as you practice those teachings, eventually that wisdom becomes your own. But it starts off with confidence. Why do you have confidence in those teachings? Well, usually because you already have a degree of wisdom. It's a bit of a catch-22. Wisdom and confidence, sadha and panya, kind of revolving around each other. And if you haven't got that a little bit of wisdom, if you haven't got that feeling of, wow, these are teachings that are really good. If you haven't got that when you come across the Buddhist teachings, you think, this is just all rubbish, more superstition, or think something like that, then, of course, it's not going to happen. You're going to be stuck. And this is part of the problem there. So it is a bit of a catch-22. You have to come into this world with a certain disposition. And if you haven't got that disposition, then of course it's going to be very hard to make any progress on this path, get anywhere. So where does confidence and faith come from? Now we come towards the very beginning of this sequence. And the confidence and faith comes from hearing the Saddhamma, the true Dhamma, the Dhamma that is in accord with reality, the Dhamma that leads eventually to liberation and freedom. Here in the Dhamma is where confidence arises from. And I'm sure that all of you will have some you know, a lot of confidence in his teachings already. Or at least most of you, I don't know, maybe some of you are a bit more new to these teachings. So you already have that confidence, yeah? And when you hear these teachings, I'm sure you will see the logic and how it all hangs together really nicely when you hear about them. And sometimes maybe not everything that you will agree with, not everything that you will be able to relate to, but kind of overall you have some feeling that there is something really powerful and wonderful going on here. And this is the something about these teachings that really are very, that draw you in, and you really feel that these things are special. And it reminds me, because I recently went back to do my own father's funeral back in Norway. It's a couple of months ago now, and that was a very nice thing to do, to do your father's or parents' funeral. It's a really nice way to say the final goodbye, to be able to be in charge of the funeral service and kind of wish them well on the future journey. But what was more interesting than that, or not what was also interesting, I should say, is that in that assembly of people who came to the funeral, there was a very large group of people, over 200 probably, came to the funeral service, and I was the only Buddhist. Most other people, they were probably just materialists, yeah, they were kind of into their cars and into their houses and into all kind of stuff, and they probably, not many of them would have been very spiritual at all. Perhaps there were some people there who were interested in meditation, because these days, there's so many people interested in meditation practice. But by and large, they had no idea about Buddhism. And so when I did the funeral service, what I did, I didn't say anything about Buddhism. I didn't make it religious, because I know that people in Norway, they're kind of really averse to religion. Probably a bit like here in Australia, but maybe even more so, I'm not sure. And so I didn't make it religious, but I used Buddhist principles when I talked. And just using those Buddhist principles, but using it in a secular way, so it's kind of a covert Buddhism, yeah? Buddhism hidden by kind of very sneaky, yeah? Don't tell anyone. And it was amazing the effect that had on people. Afterwards, people would come up and say, this was the best funeral service they ever had in their life. They felt inspired by a funeral service. They always thought funeral services was all about crying and being sad. Yeah, that's what they are very often in Christianity. But this was uplifting. And people were so happy, incredibly happy with that. So much incredibly good feedback. And these from people who had no interest in spirituality whatsoever. So often the biggest hinder very often in getting these teachings out there is actually getting people to listen. Yeah, because we don't really go knocking on doors. So how do we get people interested in these things? That's often the biggest hindrance. Once people hear these teachings, actually they find them very interesting. This is what this is about, hearing the Sadhamma, hearing the true teachings. It tends to give rise to confidence in people, because these teachings are, they talk to you directly to your heart. You know that these things are true. When someone tells you that being kind leads to happiness, you know it's true. Everybody knows that's true. Not everybody, but most people know deep down that there is a truth to that. When you live well, when you're kind to others, you feel good about yourself. It's just so bleeding obvious. How can you not know that? It sort of makes sense, yeah? And so that is how these teachings are so powerful. And sometimes I think one of the things that we need to do in Buddhism to attract more people, make the teachings accessible, make it available to people, but we have to take down some of the barriers to entry. And the barriers to entry are often too much rituals, too many things that people are afraid of when they come to religious teachings. I remember when I first came to a monastery, I was scared. I was really scared. I saw all these weirdos wearing exactly this, yeah? Wow. And shaven heads and kind of Buddha statues and all of that. So sometimes we have to kind of bring the barriers down. We have to remember what it is like not to be a Buddhist. I have forgotten now. It's a long time ago since I started. I haven't fully, entirely forgotten, but kind of it starts to fade into the background. And remember that. And then there is maybe more chance that we'll be able to share these wonderful teachings with society at large. And I think Australian society and many European Western societies are turning away from traditional religions, and they need something to fill the gap, to fill that hole that kind of arises when you live in a purely materialist society. I think Buddhist teachings, at least to some extent, have the potential of filling some of that gap which is there. So we need to get the Sadhamma out there. And so then what is the cause for the hearing of the Sadhamma, and the cause for hearing the Sadhamma, the true teaching, is seeing the Sapurisa. Sapurisa, the superior people, seeing the Buddha, seeing the noble ones, that is the initial point. When you see the Buddha, as I said before, when you see someone who is an Aryan, someone who is an Arahant even, then you start to see that something more is possible in this world. And already at that point, it is attractive. So we need to build up more noble ones, build up more Arahants, attract people to listen to this teaching, and then we can share these wonderful teachings with the entire world as a consequence. And that is the beginning point. That is where it all starts. It starts with hearing the word of the Buddha. It starts with having the good Kalyanamitta. And that is why the Kalyanamitta is at the root of this entire practice. Yeah, and so you just go and see the Kalyanamitta, see the Buddha often enough, hang out with the right kind of people, and gradually this whole thing grows as a consequence. So this is the most important thing here. This is where it all starts. And the reason why it starts there is because when we start out, we are deluded, we are conditioned by society. It's very hard to break out of that unless we get some, a little spark, a little seed that can grow in our mind, that kind of remind us of what really matters. Once the Buddha comes around, the Buddha is the eye of the world, the Loka Chakku, something like that. And so the Buddha arises, and the Buddha sees the world as it actually is, and then he shares it with us. And then that is how we get our information and how we get started on this path. So that initial spark is so important, and that is why Kalyanamitta is at the root of this very path. It's kind of interesting, isn't it? And the way to understand that fully, again, is to remember that these teachings, the problem with life is that there is no inherent essence in human beings. One of the important teachings of the Buddha, of course, anatta, non-self. And what that means is that we are entirely conditioned. And when you are entirely conditioned, you need a condition that leads you towards awakening. If you don't get that condition that leads you towards awakening, you're going to be carrying on in your old conditioning without heading in the right direction. And the simile I like to use to kind of make that kind of clear is like being a boat on the ocean. You are like this boat on the big wide ocean, but you are a boat without any kind of propulsion, any kind of steering mechanism. There is no rudder, there are no oars, there is no sail, there is no engine, there is nothing, just a hull, an empty hull, and that's you on the ocean. You have no way of navigating anywhere. And because you are this empty hull, you are where that hull goes is entirely dependent on the conditions around you. If the wind comes from the south, you go to the north. If the wind comes from the west, you go to the east. If the currents come from the west, you go east. And all of these external conditions are what is going to decide which direction you go. So what you have to do, you have to get that Dhamma wind. The Dhamma wind is the word of the Buddha, and that comes from the south, or it comes from wherever, and it comes and it hits the hull. And if Nibbana is in the north, and when you get the Dhamma wind from the south, then you will move in the right direction, and you will move towards Nibbana. And that is what these teachings are. They are like the Dhamma wind, heading, driving you in the right direction, and then moving you as a consequence towards that goal, and in that particular direction towards Nibbana, liberation, highest kind of happiness, ending of all suffering, and all the good things that you ever wanted in your life, and have ever wanted any past lives or whatever else there is. So this is why this is so important, because of the conditioning, and because how we are really, in the end, at the end of the day, we are the sum total of all the causes and conditions that work on us now and have worked on us in the past. And then the Buddha, and I probably bring this up now because it is actually part of this sutta, the Buddha tells you this beautiful simile of how this works. This is a simile that I think is probably maybe worthwhile bringing up on every retreat because it's so nice. And this is the simile of the rain on the mountaintop. Yeah, the simile which says that all you have to do is you have to allow that rain to keep falling on the mountaintop. And the rain here is precisely the visiting and seeing the Supsaparisa, seeing the Kalyanamitta, and then hearing the good Dhamma as a consequence of that. You have to allow that rain to keep falling and falling and falling. And when that rain falls on the mountaintop, it forms into little streams. Yeah, and there's little streams as the rain keeps on falling and falling and falling. They flow down the hillside and they fill up the little pools on the hillside. And as the rain continues to fall, eventually the pools fill up and eventually the pools overflow. And when they overflow, they fill up the large lakes. And as long as the rain keeps falling, it is the rain that is the essential point here. It has to keep on raining. Eventually, those large lakes also fill up until they also overflow. And then they overflow into the large rivers. The large rivers swell up. And as the rain continues, eventually those large rivers, they reach the ocean itself. And the ocean itself is here, Nibbana. So as long as you keep that rain falling at the beginning, as long as you keep on listening to the true Dhamma, as long as you allow yourself to be brainwashed, yeah, allow yourself to be conditioned, it's just another word for conditioning really, as long as you allow yourself to be conditioned by that true Dhamma, continuous, again and again and again, then this path will gradually tend to develop as a consequence. That is the most important thing here. It's fascinating. Yeah, it sounds too easy to be true. Yeah, just come here, listen to a few teachings, and before you know it, bang, Nibbana. That's the theory. Yeah, the practice is a bit more involved, but that's kind of how it works in theory. Yeah. So, but it's a beautiful way of looking at the Dhamma, because that root conditioning is the most important part of everything else. Everything comes out of root conditioning, and as you keep on conditioning yourself, gradually you're heading in the right direction. Yeah. Of course, you have to find through that conditioning, you have to be wise about how you condition it yourself, you have to apply yourself to the path and all of these things, but the root cause is always the conditioning from the Sadhamma and the true teachings of the Buddha. So, that is one of those beautiful little similes. Now, let us see how this works in the reverse order. So I forgot to mention the other five senses. Let me bring in now the other five senses. Furthermore, a mendicant hears an agreeable sound with the ear, smells an agreeable odor with the nose, tastes an agreeable flavor with the tongue, feels an agreeable touch with the body, knows an agreeable thought with their mind. They don't desire it or enjoy it, and they don't give rise to greed. Their mind and body are steady internally, well settled and well freed. But if they know a disagreeable thought, they're not dismayed. Their mind isn't hardened, dejected, or full of ill will. Their mind and body are steady internally, well settled and well freed. So all of the six senses are included in this. And then we have the sequence going from there all the way up to awakening. So I will look at just the remainder of the sutta. When the mendicant's mind and body are steady internally, they are well settled and well freed when it comes to both agreeable and disagreeable sights, sounds, smells, tastes, touches and thoughts. That's how sense restraint is developed and cultivated so as to fulfill the three kinds of good conduct. Actually, maybe one thing I didn't mention is the idea of both mind and body being steadied internally. And of course, this is to do with a close connection with mind and body. So if you're able to keep your mind under control, the body is also under control. Always a very close connection between the two. So you fulfill the three kinds of good conduct because your mind is in a good state, in good shape, and it has the right kind of ideas, the right kind of thoughts, etc. And how are the three kinds of good conduct developed and cultivated so as to fulfill the four kinds of mindfulness meditation? A mendicant gives up bad conduct by way of body, speech and mind, and develops good conduct by way of body, speech and mind. That's how the three kinds of good conduct are developed and cultivated so as to fulfill the four kinds of mindfulness meditation. So once these things are developed to a sufficient degree, that is when you're able to do the meditation practice. As we have seen so many times already, the idea that the mind it's so important to have the mind in the right place, otherwise mindfulness is not going to arise. such an important thing, this, to understand the connection between sila and mindfulness. Such an incredibly important point, and it really what makes this whole thing possible. How are the four kinds of mindfulness meditation developed and cultivated so as to fulfill the seven awakening factors? A mendicant meditates by observing an aspect of the body, keen, aware and mindful, rid of desire and aversion for the sensory world. The meditate observing an aspect of feelings, an aspect of mind, an aspect of principles, keen, aware and mindful, rid of desire and aversion for the sensory world. That's how the four kinds of mindfulness meditation are developed and cultivated so as to fulfill the seven awakening factors. So there you are, this is your meditation practice, and it takes you from good conduct all the way, eliminating the last refined aspects or defilements of the mind, making the mind, unifying the mind, and then eventually leading to samadhi here. So this is the next one. How are the seven awakening factors developed and cultivated so as to fulfill knowledge and freedom? And again, a mendicant develops the awakening factors of mindfulness, investigation of principles, energy, rapture, tranquility, immersion and equanimity, which rely on seclusion, rely on fading away, rely on cessation and ripen as letting go. That's how the seven awakening factors are developed and cultivated so as to fulfill knowledge and freedom. So it's a really nice overview of the path. It gives you a lot of clarity about what is going on, how one thing leads to the next one. So you can see here, a lot of this path here is very automatic. So once you start getting to the satipatthanas, things are almost automatic. It almost just happens by itself. You sit back, you allow the breath to be. You have a little bit of a wholesome desire to watch the breath, otherwise the breath just disappears. But basically it is about being the passenger on the train. And all of the last part of the path here, it happens just naturally as that passenger. So the work that you have to put in is in the earlier part of the path. The real work is in again, coming back to kindness, coming back to living well, coming back to right view, reading the suttas, immersing yourself in the suttas, and understanding that outlook that the Buddha has. The closer you come to the Buddha's outlook, the more you purify the virtue, the rest of the path is almost an automatic process. So, what happens then? What happens then is that when he said this, the Venerable Kundalya said to the Buddha, "Excellent, Master Gotama, excellent." As if he were writing the overturned, or revealing the hidden, or pointing out the path to the lost, or lighting a lamp in the dark so that people with good eyes can see what's there. Master Gotama has made the teaching clear in many ways. I go for refuge to the Master Gotama, to the teaching, and to the mendicant Sangha. From this day forth, may Master Gotama remember me as a lay follower who has gone for refuge for life. And there you have many of those little similes there, are similes about precisely about how what happens when you see things right. You're writing the overturned, suddenly you're seeing things in the other way around. The world gets turned upside down. What you thought was happiness before turns out to be suffering, and vice versa. It is a major shift in perception. Revealing the hidden, you are kind of withdrawing away the veil, if you like, from the world, so you can see things clearly, rather than being veiled by the hindrances, being distorted by the hindrances, and now you can see what is actually there. And then pointing out the path to the lost, instead of wandering around in samsara, remember the idea of roaming around from life to life. Instead of roaming, you're now walking with purpose. You have a direction. You're moving towards a real goal, moving towards something that finally will satisfy you and make you happy once and for all. Lighting a lamp in darkness, another one of these important metaphors that you find in the suttas, of turning on the light so you actually can see what is there and you can understand what you have to do. And this is what he is saying there. And then, as a consequence, That is when you become a lay follower, and you become a lay follower for life, it says here. This is just people being inspired. They say that they're going to be lay follower for life, and sometime later they renounce that and they're no longer lay followers. That happens sometimes, but at that moment anyway, you are very inspired by what is happening. So that is the seven factors of awakening for you. And we have now looked at 29 out of 37 of these Bodhipakya Dhammas, the 37 aids to awakening. We're coming very close to the end of the path. And hopefully you have some better understanding now what they are all about. The very last thing we're going to have a look at is the Noble Eightfold Path, because I'm not going to look at that in great detail, because it's just too involved, because the Noble Eightfold Path really is in itself a full practice from the very beginning all the way to the very end. So that would be, Noble Eightfold Path will be tomorrow morning, just a brief exposition of that and a brief look at it. But that is all for now. So keep on enjoying your evening, your meditation, and then we'll meet you again at 7:30 this evening here.